Hello again and welcome to Running Dialogue, a podcast about movies. And today we're going to be talking about Twilight Eclipse and The Last Airbender. And since it's usually kind of a boys club on this podcast, and Twilight, I think it's not controversial to say, is more of a female-driven franchise, we have some guests this week. So I'm Kurt Holman with Creative Loafing, and let's introduce ourselves so people can identify our voices.
I'm Russ Fisher from SlashFilm.com.
I'm Matt Goldberg. I'm from Collider.com.
I am Debbie Michaud, the arts and entertainment editor at Creative Loafing.
And I'm Besha Rodell. I'm the food and drink editor at Creative Loafing.
And we should say that that Besha is the closest to a twihard in this group,
Lord.
Since she has read the books and knows the franchise, you know. And Debbie is kind of a Twilight newbie, not having seen any of the movies or read the books, you know,
correct,
before the first one. And also, since Debbie's my editor and it's my copy, everything she says will be witty and intelligent, and I will agree with it all. So who wants to kind of run down through what happens in Eclipse this time? Does someone want to?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I'll go for it. All right. So at the end of New Moon, Bella's played by Kristen Stewart, says, "I want to become a vampire." And Edward replies, "Okay, but you have to marry me first." So this whole film is about her wanting to become a vampire so she can be with Edward forever for some reason, because he's such an interesting chap. And then the choice is to remain human with her family, who's kind of nice.
Yeah.
And have a life where she grows and develops as a person. But that choice is represented more by the other man in her life, Jacob, who wants to inform her what she's feeling at all times, that she's really in love with him.
I mean,
she doesn't know it, but she is.
Yeah. His like point that's actually a pretty good point, that like you could be with me and be human and not lose all your friends, is kind of undermined by his weirdly stalkerish behavior.
And apparently
the allergy to shirts.
Exactly. And apparently Bella can't walk on her own, but he's totally willing to carry her shirtless. At least Eclipse does crack one joke about the shirtlessness.
Yeah.
Whereas
best
new
line of the movie, absolutely.
So, but wait, are we talking about when Robert Pattinson says, like, who plays Edward, does he even have a shirt?
Does he even own a shirt?
Or, because I laughed when there's a part when Bella's like freezing in the tent on a mountaintop for reasons that we'll get to in just a minute. And to keep her warm, you know, Jacob tells Edward, who's there, it's like, well, I'll just get in the sleeping bag with her for the skin to skin contact. Implicitly, he doesn't say that literally, but he says, you know, let's face it, I'm hotter than you, you know.
Right. And then the audience cheered.
And the audience squeals.
But the conflict, other than the choice in Eclipse, is that there's this character, Victoria, from the first movie, and she was recast by Bryce Dallas Howard. And Victoria's still sore that Edward killed her boyfriend in the first movie. She just can't get over it.
It was two movies ago.
Exactly. Yeah. Seriously. So anyway, she's out to kill Bella and the Cullens, and the Cullen clan. Edward is part of them. And so she's building what is, quote unquote, an army.
Mm-hmm.
Which consists of about 15 people.
Yeah.
And so she's coming to the town of Forks to go after Bella, and the vampires have to...
Well, they have to team with the werewolves.
They have to team with their sworn enemies.
Historic and natural enemies, yes.
Yeah. Right.
To fight this army of newborn vampires who, because they're not newborn in the sense of being babies, but they're freshly turned as vampires.
That'd be awesome. That would be awesome.
The vampire babies. Well,
that comes. You'll get there.
You'll spoil it. little Breaking Dawn humor there. So there's a big fight between like the Cullens and the werewolves versus these newborn vampires who have blood rushing through their veins, so are allegedly stronger than the regular vampires, but we never actually see them seem to be that much stronger.
Seem to be kind of pushovers. And I mean, this movie is directed by David Slade, who made Hard Candy, which is a pretty good movie, and 30 Days of Night, which is a really terrible vampire movie. And there's this idea that, like, okay, he's going to kind of bring the boy angle to this movie. He's going to make it more violent. There's more overt physical conflict in this movie. And that's certainly there, but it's amusing that, like, I just kept thinking of the Superman character Bizarro, you know, who's this guy who's this kind of like white, crystalline, blocky alter Superman. Because every time a vampire gets killed in this movie, they're just kind of broken into these like chalky bits or something. They kind of break off like mannequins.
It's like they're made out of cinder blocks. And, yeah. Ice.
Well, that's the whole thing. They're frozen and dead inside. And
sure, yeah.
Whatever.
I get that.
That's fine. It didn't bother me that that's how they get destroyed. And I will say that the action scenes were one of the few things I liked in the movie. I thought they were, for the most part, well directed. There's some pretty crummy slow motion shots where characters are jumping in really weird ways. But for the most part, I thought the action was much better directed than it was in the first two movies. Especially when you go back to the first Twilight and just watching them run and how awful that looked.
Well, the whole sort of ice break apart thing was new to me, obviously, because I was unfamiliar with the story, and it seemed like a really easy kill for a being that is supposed to have such supernatural great powers.
They just break if you hit them.
It's like no garlic, no crucifixes, you don't have to jump through any hoops. If you could just hit the right pressure point, the vampire was done. It seemed too easy. But.
Yeah, there's, well, the kind of, I mean, the there's this whole training sequence in the movie where they're, you know, they're being trained to fight these newborns. And the training sequence just seemed kind of absurd. It seems like they could have just made some flashcards and handed them out. Like, don't get beat.
Yeah.
That's pretty much, yeah.
I mean, it does seem fair that at least they crumble fairly easily because they don't obey the other vampire rules in terms of stakes. They can, when they go out into sunlight, they don't burst into flames. They burst into sparkles.
Yeah.
So,
and that's why they're in the Pacific Northwest, because it's cloudy. So I told Debbie that during the movie because she was asking, how come they can go out into sunlight? And I said, because of the sparkly thing. And she was like, awesome.
How strategic.
Yeah. Well, so, well, like, as you know, more a fan of the books, or certainly somebody who's read the books, how does this movie feel as a translation?
It holds the exact same place as the books, which is, you know, like taking a bunch of narcotics and getting into a lukewarm bath. I mean, that's kind of the way that
opening up a couple veins.
Yeah, I mean, at the time when I read the books in my life, I just really needed an easy in back into reading because I had been so busy and stressed that I needed something really dumb that didn't need any emotional or, you know, I just didn't need any energy from me.
Right.
And they worked really well in that way, and they're the worst books ever. I mean, I'm sorry. I enjoyed them immensely, but they're so bad. And I really enjoyed this movie because it was hysterical. You know, I went with my sister and one of my girlfriends, and we laughed all the way through it. And the people around us were really mad at us for laughing at, you know, all these really intense moments. I kept clapping my hands over my eyes when Taylor Lautner would speak because he just is, I mean,
that face.
It makes you want to rip your own face off. It really does. He's so painful to watch. But having said that, it was, you know, pretty enjoyable for all those reasons. I thought it was hysterical. I think that Edward has gotten really less hot. He was pretty hot in the first movie. Like, I found him attractive in the first movie. Now he's all square-headed and weird. Like, I don't know what happened to him. And I know a lot of women really find Taylor Lautner really cute, but I just find, I look at him and I'm like, oh my God, I'm so glad I don't have to kiss high school boys anymore. Like, that kind of sweaty face thing is so gross. But yeah,
he just looks like Jersey Shore to me.
He does look
like
Jersey
I look at him
Shore.
And I see the situation.
Yes.
On a good day.
I want him to make a movie with Sarah Palin's kid. I think that they should. The Secret Life of the American Teen. I want them to get together and have scenes together. It would be so awesome. I can watch that.
Well, that's just that kind of replicates my reaction to it because I don't like not many people probably that we know like the first two movies that much, you know, and I find them just not just that they're bad, but they're just really boring and they're visually drab and they're emotionally drab and almost nothing happens in them. And in this one, it's like, I didn't think it was a good movie, but I found it a kind of entertaining movie. There's this narrative momentum with, you know, the newborns coming and the vampire plot. I mean, it moves along, and there's kind of an intentional camp level to the romantic triangle in this, like in the hotness scenes we were talking about before. So I found myself like laughing with it a little bit and at it, a fair amount. So it's like, it seems like a movie like that people who like Twilight will like it because it's Twilight. People who don't like Twilight might enjoy it. And people who don't care about Twilight should just not see it because it's not particularly interesting. Right. And it really ends where the movie starts, and not a whole lot. It doesn't really arc very far, honestly.
No, it does. I mean, it's kind of, it comes full circle in a way. You know, it's like it begins and ends in this meadow. And I didn't get anything out of the whole newborn thing because I kept having to remind myself why they're worried about Victoria in the first place, and like what this character is even angry about and what she's doing. And then there's the Volturi, who are these kind of vampire bureaucrats slash cops slash the Vatican.
They're like from the Anne Rice series who kind of broke into this series.
Yeah.
And they serve no purpose in this movie.
Yeah, it's just like, oh, here's Dakota Fanning.
I didn't even recognize Dakota Fanning until I saw her name in the credits because it was and Dakota Fanning. And I was like,
Dakota. Yeah. You know, and I just, like, I was like, why are they in this movie? They're not really doing anything. They're just kind of here. And I got really, I don't know, I found the movie interminable. I found it to be just, it not like entertainingly bad, just really dull and lifeless. And I was kind of actively irritated by it. It was like a Canterbury Tales for abstinence, you know? It was like, it gives you these little vignettes of like, okay, here's another reason that you shouldn't have sex before marriage, or here's another reason, like, you know, you get some of the other Cullen clan's backstories, and one of them is this girl who, you know, thought she'd found the perfect guy, and it turns out that he's a cad, and then he gang rapes her with his friends, and she becomes a vampire, and I was like, that's the worst story to tell to an audience full of 10-year-olds that I've ever heard.
Oh, just just you wait. Well,
I know where Breaking Dawn goes.
It gets so much worse. And, I mean, that's the whole thing. Once you see it through this Mormon lens, everything starts to make sense. I believe that the Volturi are supposed to be Catholic. It's the Vatican, right? Pope. And it's kind of this, like, you know, moral high ground that's really evil and you know, won't let, you know. I find that really fascinating. It's brilliant in its way of how it manipulates young girls into believing that there's this romanticism in giving yourself to somebody so holy, and, you know, it's horrifying.
Right. So I'm not the only one who thinks that the whole romantic angle is just a total con.
I just don't understand what's so interesting about Bella. We were kind of whispering about that. Her hair's really pretty, but, like, she doesn't.
She's even worse in the books. Yeah. I mean, you want to kill her in the books when you read it. She's the worst
thing. Anything interesting, and she went on and on towards the end about how she's such an out, or at the very end, that final scene about how she's such an outsider in her life, and she's never fit in, and I was like,
the movie doesn't reinforce that at all.
Look like a perfectly healthy, normal teenage girl.
Yeah, so why is she like the Helen of Troy of the werewolf vampire community?
Well, the whole thing is that Bella is supposed to be this blank slate, and the female reader, exactly. And so they can just project onto her, and then through her, they can be like, "Oh, here are hot guys who will love me and think I'm the most interesting person." Whenever I go to Comic-Con and I'm sitting next to a Twilight fan, because they keep doing Twilight presentations, and I lean over and talk to them, like, oh, Kristen Stewart's the worst, you know, it's Bella's not like that. And I'm like, you only think she's the worst because she's not you. That's the whole point. Someone is defining a character, and I use defining very loosely, but you don't see yourself in Kristen Stewart. That's the problem. But what I've, just switching topics pretty quickly, to what y'all were saying a little while ago, just recently, actually. What I hate about Twilight, and it's not only that the movies are poorly made or poorly written, that's great reasons to hate it, too. But I find it absolutely insidious. Mm. I find it so insulting to women, especially it sends a really terrible message to young women about sort of let men make the decisions for you. Mm-hmm. You need to be protected.
And it's okay to get married at 17 if you really want to have sex.
Yeah.
Having sex and not
exactly. And your life, and that's okay. And your life should be defined by the men in your life. Their independence is for the weak. And that's, to me, that's just a terrible, terrible message to send to women who, to I would say young girls. There are women who can engage it actively as fantasy and just be like, oh, I don't care. It's like you were saying, terrible books, but whatever. And that's fine. I mean, junk food reading is whatever. But to women that actually take it seriously and start thinking of this as ideal love, like in New Moon, like Edward breaks into her house while she's not there. And it basically mistakes stalking and infatuation for love. And they're very different things. Yeah. And so that is why I hate the message of Twilight.
Absolutely.
And it's insidious because she is presented as this person who, you know, is always saying no and is always, you know, she's presented as somebody who has an independence about her, but then she totally gives in all the time. And, you know, I think that Kristen Stewart plays Bella incredibly well. I mean, I think she was annoying and whiny and simpering in the books, and, you know, she does that great. I mean, it's perfect. And that's what's so insidious, is that kind of idea that she has this rebellious nature, that she is somehow defining herself as tempestuous and saying no to people and being independent and the odd man out, and yet she, you know, she completely turns into an idiot who just doesn't, you know, have any self-awareness when it comes to these
bracelets?
Men.
Yeah. They're so nice. How do you say no after that bracelet?
And that ring that looked like it came from the sales counter.
Like, really?
And it's like the image of Jacob carrying Bella in her arms and like running around repeatedly. It's almost like she's a baby. Even.
Yeah.
It's
right. She can't even walk on her own.
Or she can't even like ride him in wolf form, which would look kind of cool, and like, she'd be on top and be a neat image. You know?
Yeah,
but as it is, it's like, nope, she's just going to carry. But it's funny, when I was writing my thing, I had a thought that, and this is, I'm probably the only person who will see this, and this will be weird, but it's to me that Twilight kind of reverses kind of the Judd Apatow comedy idea, where like the schlubby men woo these totally hot women, because, you know, Kristen Stewart's perfectly pretty, and, you know, Bella's pretty, but she's kind of blank. And the men are presented as being, like, so much sexier than her. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I wonder, like, the women who like the movies kind of like it for that reason, because it kind of sexualizes the men more than the women, and it's refreshing to them in a way.
Well, and certainly the female vampires are presented as being much more sexual than Bella is, and you know, much more glamorous, much more kind of... They look like celebrities, you know, basically. And so, you know, that kind of feeds into that whole idea of, oh, this is what she should want. She should want Edward, and she should
to
want
be an
this wife.
Because,
exactly. Yeah. Well, and I mean, what you're talking about as far as, you know, not making any decisions for herself, you know, this movie makes that very explicit in that scene in the tent where Jacob makes the comment about being hotter than Edward. You know, it's like that you have these two male characters arguing over the fate of the main female character as she lays between them, apparently asleep.
Yeah.
And
she's not asleep. In the book, she is pretending to be asleep, and
oh,
she overhears them.
I'm
yeah.
not going to say anything, though.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
See, I felt like that was suggested by the movie. You know, like Slade keeps cutting back to giving you shots of her with her kind of eyelids fluttering a little bit, and so I felt like, okay, I was certainly questioning whether she was awake. That seemed to be part of the scene. But still, it's horrifying and awful that she didn't sit up and, like, you know what?
Screw you guys.
Both of you guys, get out of here.
That's just
ridiculous.
Right, and it's just a creepy scene on its own. Jacob comes in, and she needs his body warmth, and so he looks at Edward. He's like, "I'm gonna cuddle your girlfriend right in front of you. How do you like that?" Because and it's this whole pissing contest between them throughout the film that's so irritating.
Well,
unless you find it hilarious, which I did.
Now, my impression from the books and the fandom of the books was that it was pretty clear cut that, like, Edward was the romantic hero in the books.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's not nearly as clear. In fact, in this movie, it seemed like Jacob was the romantic hero of this movie to me.
And
really?
I think
maybe the more tragic one automatically becomes the more romantic hero in this kind of,
I guess. I mean, I don't know. Edward just stood around looking like somebody just stuck his toe in a light socket. Like, he was so Frankenstein in this movie, you know?
He didn't even react to that kiss
at all. And he's just, you know, and and Jacob is so passionate and, you know,
he's
really trying.
In a date rapist kind
yeah,
of way.
Yeah, no, it's
true.
But
I mean, by comparison to Edward's stalking tendencies, it's at least he's at least active. You know, I can respect Jacob's approach, you know, in as much as I can respect anything in this in these movies. I mean that seems like the interesting thing here is that what was a very clear-cut relationship between the characters in the books seems to be very actively changing and being tweaked in the movies, and I think that's the only interesting thing in this film for me, was the notion that, like, okay, it's actually interpreting the books in a way that is changing the story. And I guess I find that a little bit intriguing, and it seems to be having an effect on the fan base and making them look at those characters differently. So,
I think it needed to happen to sustain two more movies, too, because by the end of this book in the series, it was very clear that she had made the choice, you know, that there wasn't really any more room for discussion about it. And they kind of get at that in the, you know, the scene where Jacob is sweating profusely and, you know, being all oiled up looking while lying on a bed, horribly hurt for her sake, but they don't really get there. I mean, right. It's not just done. And, you know, in the book, he continues to kind of tease her about it beyond this point, but there's no real question that she's, you know, she's made the decision.
Well, I think this is what you're referring to. As she's leaving, you know, he says, like, well, maybe until after living or whatever.
She would be changed to a vampire, he would still wait for her, which is...
And is the line, I'll love you until your heart stops beating, really is horrible and awful.
Yeah. It's so horrible and awful.
And then at the end, doesn't he say, I'll love you until after your heart stops beating?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm
But not in a necrophilia way.
No, just in a you'll be
that's
a vampire.
That's the choice of the movie, though. Yeah. Bestiality and necrophilia.
Exactly.
Well, I was with two women who are way bigger fans than I am in a lot of ways. And I will say this for the movie. This being the second chick flick I've seen in a row with this particular set of women, they looked at me on the way out and they said, well, it made Sex and the City look good. Which is totally true. And you put those two movies together and Twilight wins, hands down.
It's not much of a victory.
No.
It's an easy victory. Kick them all the way down.
Well, since Debbie does episode reviews of True Blood for us, which is kind of the other current vampire franchise, and kind of the opposite in terms of as being like the total sexed up vampire one, I was wondering how you think about True Blood versus thinking about Twilight.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, sex is such like a central factor in True Blood. I mean, that sex is True Blood. And the fact that in Twilight, like, sex, like, there's only two ways to look at it. It's like, sex is something you do if you're married, or it's something that hurts so bad that it kills you, you know? And like, in True Blood, it's just as sort of like violent and horrifying in so many ways in that respect, and is even get like being pushed further and further and further. In this past week, the third episode of the season three that I just reviewed, and I wasn't alone in sort of observing this, but I was writing about this sort of really, it wasn't exactly a rape scene because of the situation, but it pretty much amounted to a rape scene that involved a lot of sort of Linda Blair-esque mutilation, and so which was really creepy. And, you know, I think basically what I got from what Alan Ball is trying to do is push, like, or chip away at sexual mores to the extent that, like, the level of taboo is sort of boosted up on sort of, like, the baseline of pop culture, whereas Twilight is doing the exact opposite. It's sort of trying to create this bubble of, you know.
Yeah. How much is Suki different or like Bella? Because she's the female character played by Anna Paquin, who is a human who has a werewolf, a vampire boyfriend, too.
They're essentially the same character, except you see Suki naked all the time.
Does she make the same choices, or does she, like, let the men rule her like Bella does?
It's pretty similar. I mean, she's a little bit feistier and has a better sense of humor and some better lines than Bella does. But for the most part, it's like, yes, it's like Sookie. Oh, I love Bill. You know, Bill and I are engaged. But then you have Eric, this sort of like who was once sort of like the enemy vampire, but now there's all this sexual tension between them. And now there are werewolves involved who are incredibly attractive. So I'm sure that that will become an issue at some point. But, it's, you know, so she's technically wearing the ring that Bill gave her, but she's like, you know, and she's professing her sort of profound, you know, what do you call it, sort of commitment to Bill. But meanwhile, there is this sort of like push and pull and sexual tension between all of these other characters happening. So,
hey, maybe we should talk a little bit about what Breaking Dawn, the Breaking Dawn films are going to be, because it's one book that's being split into two movies. And since you've read them, Besha, do you have a sense of like where the split might be? And is the book itself long enough to support two films?
It's a pretty long book. My assumption is that they're going to make the wedding scene really long and, you know, just drag it out as far as they can, because they have that kind of lingering camera on things you don't want to look at kind of aesthetic about the whole thing. And that wedding, I think that's probably going to be a huge part of the next movie. And then, you know...
Does she become... spoiler alert, she becomes pregnant in Breaking Dawn.
Yes.
Does that happen? So, is she a vampire first?
No. And in fact, that's where the really, really
super creepy
evil of this series comes in. Because basically, as you saw in this movie, she says, I want to have sex with you before I'm a vampire because I want to want you the way I want you now without being distracted by wanting to kill people. Mm-hmm. You know?
Perfectly reasonable.
Yeah.
So basically,
I feel the same way.
They get married and they go on their honeymoon and they have all this sex on the honeymoon that literally almost kills her. I mean, she is. There's no sex scenes in the book. There's like the preamble and then them waking up the next day, and she is covered in bruises and
I thought you were going to say something else.
No, she's covered in bruises and she is really badly hurt, and he's horrified by this, and she's like, oh no, it's fine, let's do it again. And so you know, there's that. So I'm assuming that will be. And then the kind of, I wouldn't doubt.
How will they handle that? Is it?
Yes.
It happens
off
screen. It happens off screen.
Yeah.
The birth happens off screen.
Well, the birth happens off screen, but and the sex will happen off screen, but the waking up and being hurt will probably not. And I would assume that then the pregnancy and the everything else will happen in the last movie because, you know. So that leaves us with a movie to look forward to that is basically Edward and Bella having a wedding and a honeymoon. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that will probably be what the next movie is.
And that's so that they can keep their non-R rating, right? I mean, they could sort of show all that stuff, but it would alienate the whole audience,
is not the R rating is not a problem with that. The R rating is probably a problem with the pregnancy she has to drink a whole bunch of blood to keep the baby alive. The baby is basically killing her from within by kicking and stuff.
Like every time
vampire,
it kicks her, it breaks her ribs. Yeah.
And then
my mother never would have let me read these books when I was 12.
V.C. Andrews, though, I mean, that's what I was reading. And then so she has to drink all this blood that Carlisle gets for her from the blood bank. And then there's this scene.
I'd like to make a withdrawal.
Yeah.
So what do you need this for?
Nothing.
And then there's this scene that's actually narrated by Jacob in the last book is narrated by Jacob somewhat, which the rest of them weren't, and where she gets violently ill and throws up blood everywhere, and that is that's what I'm kind of interested in, how they're gonna, you know, deal with that, because it's very horror movie.
Well, but then it goes even crazy, because I mean, as I understand it, she's basically given a C-section by Edward.
Well, no, she's given a C-section by Carlisle, and then Edward has to...
Edward, like, eats the baby out of her.
No.
There's some kind of scary
thing where he has to do with this. It's been a while since I read it, but and then so then he turns into a vampire as she gives birth to keep her alive, because that's...
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
And then the baby, like, grow, like, really fast.
Yeah.
Well, the baby grows really fast, and so in this movie, in Eclipse... there's this whole sequence where Jacob is discussing the notion of imprinting to Bella, and how it's basically you become soulmates with someone the first time you see them, and Jacob imprints on the baby.
Yeah, and the baby grows really, really quickly. Really like every day, it's like
is it a boy or a girl?
It's a girl.
It's a girl. And
now, that
it's
would
super
be interesting
smart.
If Jacob imprinted on a boy baby, but not that, no such luck, unfortunately.
I can't believe these books are so terrible. I mean,
they sound awesome. Man.
I know exactly. It sound, kind of sounds like my favorite book.
Yeah. Yeah. Do we know when they're supposed to come out?
November 2011, and then summer or.
I don't know if the release is set for the second half yet, but yeah, November 2011. So, and they're, I mean, the scripts are not even written for the two halves of Breaking Dawn right at this point. And like Melissa Rosenberg, from who's written the scripts to the three films so far and is part of the Dexter writing staff, et cetera, she's been talking about it lately, and I don't know if a draft is done. Yeah, I mean, they don't start shooting for another couple of months, I think. So it'll be a typical – right? Well, there's kind of an interesting interview with David Slade on Movie Line today where he talked about the way that Summit is approaching these movies. And he was like, you know, most movies like this that had this fan base at another studio would have like 100 days to shoot. And they had 50 days to shoot an Eclipse. And he's like – basically, it's like, yep. Hit go. Just okay. You're hired now. Go make the movie and get back to us. And how he was just kind of like, just kind of kept my head down and did it. And I'm glad that I'm not making Breaking Dawn.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Well,
Breaking Dawn
tell.
Actually has a, not to dismiss David Slater or anything, but Breaking Dawn has the most talented of all the directors so far, Bill Condon.
It's
much better than this series deserves, but. I mean, at the same time, it does keep me kind of interested in Breaking Dawn.
Yeah. Even though Eclipse might well be the high water mark of the thing, just given what the plot of Breaking Dawn could be. So
who knows? Yeah.
I mean, there is going to be the big showdown with the Volturi and the, you know, so there's more action down the
line. Oh, so they come back. Because it seemed like they were setting something up to be manipulative, but then they never really...
Well, if you saw the first ones, there's a whole thing about how they let Bella live with the promise that she was going to be changed. And they basically said if they found out that she had not been changed, they were going to kill her. So.
And that's in Eclipse a little bit. Dakota Fanning has a line or two to that effect.
Right, and they set that up at the end of New Moon.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, okay. Well, I think we've beat this werewolf as much as we can. So, right now, I'll thank Besha and Debbie.
Thank you, guys.
Y'all can
sure,
stick around
you.
For Last Airbender if you want, but are under no obligation to do so. So.
Work calls. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks. Thanks. Thanks. Thank you.
I guess it's the Jackson Rathbone special installment because he plays Jasper in Eclipse and Sokka in The Last Airbender, which is the M. Night Shyamalan action fantasy that came out.
In the series, it's Sokka. And in this, and also the protagonist in the movie is Aang. In the series, it's Aang.
There are several
and
other names.
That gives you an idea of how much M. Night Shyamalan likes the series and likes the fans of the series, which is not at freaking all.
Well, I'll sum up the movie.
Okay.
Not ever having seen the series, not caring about the series.
Okay. Series is good, by the way.
Oh, yeah, I don't care.
Okay.
I've been told I got plenty of other good stuff to watch. I'm sure it's great. I have no problem with it.
I just want to establish.
Yeah. Oh, no, I've heard the general consensus seems to be that it is genuinely great.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan, too. And so, it's not like bad material mishandled. It's good material mishandled.
Right. So the film essentially sets up a world in which there are four nations that are defined by their relationships to the elements, earth, air, fire, and water. The Fire Nation is this massively ambitious, power-hungry, sort of evil nation. And they've wiped out the Air Nation, essentially, or think that they have. And it turns out that these two kids from a southern water nation which is essentially kind of an Inuit tribe, except the two kids are white, which is great.
Mm-hmm.
These two kids kind of find something in the water, and it turns out to be a weird bubble that contains a boy named Aang. Mm-hmm. I don't care if he's Aang in the show.
Yeah.
He's Aang in the movie.
Yeah.
And his kind of never-ending story sort of dog, dragon, the thing that flies.
Sky bison is the term. Yeah, that
yeah great.
The show.
Yeah. So so they find Aang and his pet, and it turns out that he's the last airbender. He's the last of the air nation, and
That bending is like a telekinesis people have over, you know, based on which country they're from, certain individuals can master the different elements in a kind of a X-Men telekinetic kind of way.
Sort of Tai Chi plus, plus telekinesis plus modern dance sort of thing. And so he's the last of the Air Nation. He's the last of the airbenders. And it turns out that he might also be the Avatar, which is this sort of spiritual guy, almost like a Dalai Lama sort of character, who is able to bend, i.e. manipulate, all four elements, and is kind of a unifying force in the world, and which is the Avatar has been gone for 100 years. Nobody's seen him. And it turns out that this kid is indeed the Avatar. And so he and the two Water Nation kids kind of go on this quest, essentially, to sort of free some people from the tyranny of the Fire Nation and to develop Aang's full potential as the Avatar. And there was probably some other stuff, but it didn't make a whole lot of sense.
The mission is to get him to the Northern Water Tribe so he can learn water bending as his first element.
Yeah, the show's in three seasons or books, and each one corresponds to him learning bending.
Obviously, yeah. And so in this movie, he's learning water. Yeah. And it's easy to see where the sequels that will now probably never happen.
I can only pray.
That's the story. And it's a perfectly reasonable story. It's, you know, there's a coming of age thing. There's, you know, the two Water Nation kids are a brother and sister, and the girl is a waterbender, but she's a novice. The kid is kind of this, you get the idea that he wants to be this adventurer and wants to be kind of the hero, but, you know, he's kind of a crappy hunter, and he's he's enthusiastic but a bit inept.
Right.
And
I'm sorry, I'm going to keep cutting in with the series, and I don't mean to.
Well, but see, the series doesn't matter because this is the movie.
Sure,
and what it's supposed to be with respect to the series does matter with respect to the fan base, but, you know, what it is on screen is you know.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I disagree with that in the sense of what the series represents more than the movie. Now, I agree on certain things like the characters. Like in the show, Sokka he's actually a good hunter. He's just a goof.
Right.
But he's competent.
Right.
But the larger issue is the race issue. And this has been brought up before. And to me, that's what I find really bothersome. And so it's not a character thing.
Especially the casting.
The casting goes to the issue of basically what kind of movie do we want to create and what kind of culture do we live in. And to me, you can't really talk about that in the movie without talking about the series.
Well, what I see in the movie is – I think that you can talk about it with respect to the movie because, you know, again, so this Southern Water Nation is very obviously an Inuit-based.
Sure.
It's jumping off from that. Everybody in the village is Inuit except for these two white kids and their white mom. And I think that that's perfect. You know, okay, so yeah, obviously there's a weird racial casting thing going on because why are those characters white when everyone around them, all the rest of their people – are not white. It doesn't make any sense. Yeah. You know?
One thing about it's an issue about, you know, just kind of like whitewashing in movies that happens a lot where,
absolutely,
like you've got a character who's like definitely a certain race and is cast to be white to be more commercial.
Right.
And with Avatar the show being doing this, there's a little ambiguity because even though it's the looks of the nation are very much like medieval Japan and medieval China, and the Fire Nation has like a Thai aspect to it. The show was actually created by Americans and voiced by Americans, so you can judge that, you know, whether it's authentically one race or another is kind of an open question. But some of the casting in the movie, though, like it kind of conceptually, I don't mind, but in practice, like seeing kind of this, you know, white suburban grandma with kind of the Eskimo outfit was just sort of jarring.
Yeah,
and a lot of the other, like, you know, Caucasian people with these sort of non-Caucasian costumes just look wrong, but to me that's like the least of the film's problems, really.
Seriously, so, you could as much as the whole it's being called race bending issue. Like, and to me that goes, you can talk about that before even seeing the movie. Mm-hmm. The movie taken on its own is, I need a better vocabulary because of how freaking awful it is.
Yeah.
I can't believe that someone would pay money to see this or to make it, rather. It is, I took one screenwriting class. I wish I could have taken more. But I do know that when a screenwriter just tells you things that are happening rather than shows it, that gets a failing grade.
There's like incessant like narration in it. Like it's like a 3-hour movie that they cut to 95 minutes almost.
Yeah,
you know?
it feels astoundingly condensed. Yeah. You get these... it's almost like, you know, in Night and Day you have this thing where they just drug Cameron Diaz and then she wakes up in the new scene. And in this movie they don't even bother to drug the characters. It's just like flip and then my brother fell in love with the princess. Yeah. What?
It's like it's like we're Cameron Diaz.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Know, and there's the story just it felt like a slideshow to me. Mm-hmm. It was like they go here, there's not really any establishment for why any of this stuff is important. A couple people do some things and the good example is the two Water Nation kids and Aang end up in this Earth village that has been sort of subjugated by the Fire Nation. Basically, Aang is kind of like, you guys are powerful. What are you doing? Why are you letting these guys run roughshod over you?
Why you let them know that they can really step up?
Yeah. Exactly. Go. Yeah. Exactly. So, you know, and then there's a little fight, and then the Earth villagers rise up, and they eject the Fire Nation, all that. But it just doesn't feel like it means anything, because it comes out of nowhere, and his speech is lame, and then there's some fighting, and the fighting is lame, and none of the action of this movie feels like it has any weight or consequence to it. It looks like Tai Chi dancing,
and the effects are horrible. There's no flow to them. These effects aren't clever in their use. You have these elements, right? Well, how can you use them in an interesting way? Mm-hmm. Aang can essentially fly, but they don't really take advantage of that. He has the staff that is a glider, barely gets used. Mm-hmm. And
it's his escape tool.
His escape tool, but he doesn't use it in fighting. And I could just jump from terrible thing to terrible thing. Seriously, like you were talking right now, I'm like, you know, he gives this rallying speech, and I'm like, and Noah Ringer couldn't act his way out of a paper freaking bag. Yeah.
And he uses his nostrils a lot.
Yeah.
And he looks helpless. He looks really helpless and scared.
Yeah.
And that's a thing that really bothers me, because you can talk about, you know, maybe they didn't have enough money or they didn't have enough time and how condensed it is. But there is nothing – it costs nothing to have a character tell a joke. It costs nothing to create a small character moment that defines someone.
Yeah.
And I was – as I was watching the movie, I just kept thinking of like, here's a line you could say. Here's a line you could say.
Right.
And to me, I just kept thinking – you know, Shyamalan, I just want you to stop.
Yeah.
Stop. Go to director jail. Yeah. Throw away the key. Never come out again.
My kind of reaction to it was that, you know, this makes, you know, Star Wars The Phantom Menace look like Star Wars The Empire Strikes Back.
Right.
And he doesn't seem to have given any thought to, like, you know, what made, you know, the fantasy elements of, like, the first Star Wars movies, like, relatable to the audience with, like, human touches and funny details and things like that. And it's kind of amazing that, the good guys in this character have, like, they fly around on this big furry animal, and they have a bat lemur or lemur bat as, like, a furry animal familiar. And they don't do anything don't do anything funny except for maybe some arguably funny things. And it's like, why even take these from the show if you're not going to do anything with them?
Who is this movie for?
Mm-hmm.
It's not for the fans.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're not familiar with the show, it's still terrible.
Yeah.
So who is it for? I think it's for M. Night Shyamalan's ego.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't like casting aspersions as to what a filmmaker, their emotional state or anything like that. But at the same time, it feels incredibly arrogant and that I'm better than the material. Mm-hmm. And look at me go with my big expensive movie that actually looks like crap.
Mm-hmm. Well, in part it looks like crap because it was post-converted into 3D. Mm-hmm. Although the 3D is so negligible that it is – I mean, you can take your glasses off through half the movie and it looks like a normal 2D mm-hmm. projection with the background a little more out of focus. Mm-hmm. There's almost no useful or interesting 3D in this movie to speak of. But the ultimate effect is that you're wearing these glasses that darken the picture considerably. Yeah. They make a couple of the battle scenes really, really difficult to watch mm-hmm. because you can't see what's happening. They make the effects look worse than I think they are mm-hmm. because they're made to look darker. And yes, there's no particular imagination behind the effects mm-hmm. in terms of the way these elements are being used, so that's a problem. But the rendering of them is okay mm-hmm. until you're looking at them through these glasses that severely dim the image. And you've got these pans across these, you know, the film was shot in some kind of cool looking locations and, you know, and on a couple of sets that, you know, occasionally look cool and occasionally look like, you know, Iron Maiden's tour set from 1988, which, you know, I was at that show. It was a great show, but I don't, you know, need to see it in 3D. And, you know, it's like, but the 3D just makes it look awful because as he pans around these things, it's blurry. It's nausea inducing. It's really unpleasant to watch.
If you went to see this movie, and I beg you not to, and pay to just see it in 2D, because throw your money away that way instead of seeing it in 3D, and because you'll be throwing away more money.
Yeah, don't see the movie, but if you do, don't see it in 3D, you know.
It's Clash of the Titans all over again.
But, I'll draw the line there, because Clash of the Titans has, like, some really, like, horrible 3D where it's like, or like Ralph Fiennes' forehead would be sticking out further than his brow. And this has it doesn't have bad 3D, it's just non-existent.
Well, I think that the camera panning stuff, I think that those big wide-angle pans are really bad because mm-hmm. they're uncomfortable and I had to look away because it's so blurry and so distracting and awful
and
looking.
The action scenes are kind of set around big mm-hmm. panning and trying to do them in one shot. It's, oh gosh, it's bad on so many levels. Yeah. I could go on and on about everything I hated about this movie.
But the bottom line is it's very miscast. Mm-hmm. It's very poorly written. I mean, you've got things like, you know, the Fire Nation is one of the lead representatives of the Fire Nation is played by Dev Patel from Slumdog Millionaire, and he's the prince who's been cast out for this, you know, kind of trumped up insult. And he's trying to find the Avatar to redeem himself. So he wants to find the Avatar, take him back home so that Dad will let him back in. And I know this because he tells us that like four times in the movie. There's no attempt to build a character out of him. There's no attempt to give him any interesting thing to do. There's no attempt to have him articulate what he wants in any way other than by saying exactly what he wants.
That's the whole film. It just tells you things. I mean, I would have settled for a simple flashback where he's remembering, you know, what happened. It haunts him. Instead, that scene is, you know, he calls a little boy over.
Here, like, narrate my history.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. And he's like, tell me what you've heard about me.
But you don't even really need that because Asif Manvi is like kind of an even more dickish Fire Nation general who like basically
– I kind of liked him. He was better than I thought he would be in terms of – because I only know him from The Daily Show. Mm-hmm. And I thought he was
– He's the senior Fire Nation correspondent.
Exactly.
He's one of the campier elements in the movie. And as such, he at least stands out. There's something more to him than this very flatline character affect, which defines almost everybody else in the movie.
One thing, as much as I'm mad at M. Night Shyamalan for basically pissing all over this show that I really like, is that – but I'm mad at Nickelodeon for giving it to M. Night Shyamalan, because even if you like him, what in his resume would have said, oh, here's the guy to make this, you know? I mean, his best movies are these kind of quiet Hitchcockian kind of things, but he's never shown like – world building or fast-paced action or comedy, you know, which is all about
forecasting.
You know, yeah.
Right, and he's never built up to it. And look at his past movies. They're terrible. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, how do you give this guy money? It's like, you know what, let's just give you way more money than you deserve to handle what we want to be a really successful franchise that will bring us in a lot of money. And I mean, I can't fathom why Paramount would have done that. And I really hope that this film tanks. Mm-hmm. And yet, even if it does, I still lose because A, there's a good Airbender movie to be made. Mm-hmm. There's a good Last Airbender movie that you could make. It won't happen for at least maybe 10, 15 years because people think, this can't succeed. And then people who haven't seen the series, they'll see this movie. It's like, oh, the series must suck. And it doesn't.
Yeah.
So this film just – even if it dies, it just takes everything down with it.
It's essentially the – it's essentially the Golden Compass done all over again but just on a much crappier scale.
That's a good analogy, unfortunately. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's like good source material, interesting, potentially great movie to be made, and then a lifeless, pointless, first movie in the quote-unquote franchise, which – is then put out to pasture afterwards.
Yeah. I will say that Golden Compass was – I didn't like it, but I thought it was closer. And this one is like almost like a joke.
Yeah. I mean there's – there's
– terrible, terrible joke.
Yeah. When I finally saw – I didn't see the Golden Compass when it was first out because I do – I don't love those books, but I've read them and I like them well enough that I was kind of like, I don't really – I didn't have to see the movie, and I wasn't assigned it, and so I was like, okay, I'm going to wait. And when I finally did see it, it wasn't as bad as I expected, but it's certainly not
good. It had Razzlin' polar bears.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's certainly not bad on this level by any means, but very little is – I mean, we just finished talking about Eclipse and how terrible Eclipse is, and this Airbender is worse than Eclipse.
By far,
it's worse than Jonah Hex. It's worse than Clash of the Titans.
I will be disturbed if there's a movie worse than The Last Airbender this year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that will really because this just punched me in the soul.
Yeah,
and there was a point earlier this year when I was predicting a bunch of us had a sort of a pool going in terms of what might be, and it's kind of anathema to me to predict box office, but to say, well, okay, what might be the top earners of the summer, and I had this relatively high on my list because there is such a fan base for the show and because some of the trailers didn't look horrible. Mm-hmm. And so seeing this now, it's like, wow, God, it's
ironically, the scenes in like the first teaser are not in this movie.
Oh, really? I don't recall the teaser.
There was an early teaser with Aang his airbending in a castle and you panned out and the Fire Nation ships are approaching and like launching fireballs at him, which is from like a – which is kind of from an episode,
Yeah, but it's like a proof of concept thing more than... Yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
So, but, this is... It's a stunning... It's an amazing failure, and now it's a string of... Makes his string of failures stand at 4. Mm-hmm. Well, I would say 5, because I really don't like Unbreakable either. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, Unbreakable is a more palatable movie, but then you go to... you go to the village, you go to Lady
like
in the Water.
Two-thirds of the village. I think the village is actually well-directed in terms of its imagery. I actually think it's a kind of a good story, and then it just completely falls apart in the third act it just implodes on itself.
To me, the village is very much like this movie is. It's a first act. Mm-hmm. The village is a story that gets interesting when Bryce Dallas Howard's character knows what's going on and then gets back to the village with this knowledge and is like, okay, here's the credits.
Yeah.
It's like or at best it's two acts of a movie. Mm. It's like he disengages from that story as soon as it's actually gonna turn interesting. And then, the less said about Lady in the Water and the happening, the better.
Well, to me, Lady in the Water is the schizophrenic film where there are moments that I actually think are really good and the imagery is strong and you get these glimmers of like, oh, this sort of mythical movie, taken to the modern stance, and then it just flips over to something just absolutely wretched.
Yeah.
So, and then The Happening is better than this because The Happening is at least laughably bad. It's so bad it's good. This is the worst. M. Night Shyamalan used to be known for his twists, and to me the twist for him now would be to make a mediocre movie. One that I just didn't outright hate. And I think studios need to stop letting him make movies because there have been, better directors that get less play for making like maybe one flop.
Yeah.
This is I pray this flops. Mm-hmm. I pray.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. No. I mean, you know, there's certainly people who've been thrown into director jail for significantly less, and we need like. Shyamalan needs to go into like the director phantom zone or something.
Yeah, the director gulag.
Yeah,
he'll find a way to ruin that too.
Exactly.
Yeah. Do we want to do movie picks?
Sure.
I don't have one, but I could probably come up with one during the conversation.
Okay.
So.
One I wanted to bring up during Jonah Hex, but I didn't know if we had mentioned it before, was Hunger. Because
we had not mentioned Hunger.
We had not mentioned Hunger. In fact, on Collider, I've now kept a running list of everything we have, mm-hmm. you know, for helpful to our readers, but also to me because I'm going to lose track. So I thought we might have mentioned Hunger before, but I wanted to bring it up because Michael Fassbender, who's one of the few good things in Jonah Hex, mm-hmm. Hunger is sort of his breakthrough performance and is beyond amazing. And so to lay out the plot, it's directed by Steve McQueen, not – the dead one, but another guy named Steve McQueen who just does this remarkable job. It's such a well-directed film, but it takes place during a hunger strike in a prison in Ireland during, I believe it takes place in 1980, 1981. And it's a sort of an odd duck of a film that it starts off with people you think are going to be the central characters, but they're not. They're sort of there to show you what the situation is in the prison. But it's Fassbender's character who is, I guess you could call the protagonist. He's the one that goes on the hunger strike. He's the one who organizes these rebellions and strikes and things like that. He's the guy who has connections to the outside. And it's just such a remarkable performance. There's this one scene where he's talking to a priest. He's already, you know, saying we're going to do a hunger strike. And the priest is kind of trying to talk him out of it. The scene does not cut away. It's just two people talking in profile. It's all acting. Nothing changes. No close-ups. Like, they have this long conversation, and then there is a close-up on Fassbender telling a story that happened to him, an anecdote that's relevant to what he's about to do. And then we see his hunger strike, and it's just so brutal. And I believe that if you're not on the how great Michael Fassbender is – see this movie because you're going to start seeing a lot of him. He was recently cast as Magneto in the upcoming new X-Men movie, X-Men First Class.
Prequel, so he'll be younger than
Ian McKellen, he'll be younger than Ian McKellen, but he's just a tremendous actor. Hunger is just a great film on its own. I think the direction is phenomenal. You can catch – it's a Criterion, but you can catch it on Netflix Watch Instantly, and I highly encourage you to do so.
Mm-hmm. I've been kind of all over the place the past week or two just watching a lot of stuff that – like literally I'll just kind of open the Netflix – you know, the Netflix main page and whatever I haven't seen or haven't seen recently that's listed on like the – that's in that front page of like 16 movies and be like, okay, fine, you know. So just kind of rolling dice. And as a result, I rewatched Spartan, David Mamet's movie.
Okay.
Which is – I really think is a fantastic movie and something that I think a lot of people still haven't seen.
I haven't seen it.
I've seen it.
And it's – so Spartan is – it's essentially hinges around this sort of subset of the Secret Service that watches over – this unit of the Secret Service that's watching the president's daughter. And she is abducted out from under their nose. And so one of the agents, Val Kilmer – kind of goes – essentially starts going through this, you know, path of almost like a – it becomes a detective movie for a minute as he's trying to figure out what's happened. And he's got Derek Luke along for the ride who's a new recruit to this unit. And it's just – there's some great character work from Val Kilmer. He does a really fantastic job. Luke is great. The entire cast is fantastic. You get really good work from William H. Macy in a cool kind of surprising role. And it's just, you know, it's a Mamet movie, so it's quiet, it's very spare. There's no fat to it, nothing. It doesn't linger anywhere longer than it needs to, but it's got a great punch and some really cool things happen and really surprising things. And just as like a low-key, really well-done thriller with action elements, it's a really fantastic little movie.
It's the darkest version of First Kid ever.
Yes, it is that, too.
The darkest version of First Daughter.
Yeah.
And no, but it's a solid film.
Yeah. And I also watched finally Stones in Exile, which is the hour long documentary about the Rolling Stones essentially writing and recording most of Exile on Main Street. And I'm a big fan of Rolling Stones movies. I was never a huge Stones fan as a kid, and somehow I kind of became more of a Stones fan and have written a certain amount about a bunch of their movies, bunch of the movies that chronicle them. And Stones in Exile is good. It's not great. It's still photographs and old, you know, period footage of them from when they were in the south of France recording this record. And then narration kind of unifies the whole thing. So it's really built just from narrated interviews with Keith Richards, Mick Jagger, Bill Wyman, Charlie Watts, and then some of the other guys who played on the record and like their tour manager at the time, things like that. But as a archival document, it's kind of interesting because a lot of the film footage that's in it is from the film Cocksucker Blues, mm-hmm. which was sort of famously shot and edited and then barred from release by the mm-hmm. Stones because it showed them in a less than flattering light. Mm-hmm. You know, the film shows is relatively explicit in showing, like, you know, IV drug use. Mm-hmm. And there's a scene in the film where they're on a plane, they're on, like, you know, the Stones' private jet flying to a show, and they've got a couple of groupies that have come along with them, and the band and the roadies around them basically all start kind of like chanting and clapping mm-hmm. as they're trying to get these girls to take their clothes off. And it's, you know, it's an uncomfortable, weird thing. Mm-hmm. And it's Cocksucker Blues is a great movie because it's the other side yeah. of the like rock star, you know, typical rock star portrait. It's ugly and it's very unvarnished. And
for it by name.
Exactly, right? And you can't find it. It's a bootleg only thing. But a lot of that footage shows up in Stones in Exile, which is, and it's, you know, not, obviously it's the more, it's not sanitized footage, but it's the footage that shows just a little bit more pure performance and recording and the band and not so much the unsavory stuff. But if you're a fan and you've ever heard about that movie and wanted to see it, then some of that footage is in Stones in Exile.
Yeah. Well, I'll use Last Airbender to inspire, in a roundabout way, my pick. Last Airbender, one of the things, I don't think the movie establishes it as well, but I think the show does, with the fact that the different kinds of bending are animated with a different kind of martial art. I don't know if you could tell by the martial arts in the movie, but
it all looks like Tai Chi.
Yeah, it's pretty poorly done in the film.
And because of the costumes and the wacky martial arts stuff, you know, it evokes all that kind of tradition of like Hong Kong films and like which Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon is kind of the most popular version of. And thinking about that reminds me of one called A Chinese Ghost Story 2. And since Russ has a laptop, I'll ask if he could look it up because I'm blanking on the name of the filmmaker. And, you know, the name kind of says it all. It's just sort of like this medieval China supernatural action romp. I mean, in memory, it's almost like a Chinese Abbott and Costello ghost story movie where, you know,
I am so sold already.
There's it's like great. There's yeah. fighting and monsters, and I mostly remember a scene where I saw it before Chinese Ghost Story 1, so it didn't make a difference, where one guy, there's like these two young guys, and one of them is learning to do like these like magic spells, and he gets a spell where he freezes people and doesn't kind of realize it, so his like friend gets frozen without his knowledge, and his friend sees this big, very cheap-looking ogre coming into the space where they are and can't do or say anything. And there's all this, like, freezing and unfreezing that happens. And then they're basically, the two guys and the ogre are all frozen, like, right under the ogre's claws, and they can't move. But the ink that makes the spell work is dripping, so they're getting to move more. And then once they move, the ogre will get them. So it's like, how are they going to get out of this? So it's one of those, like, crazy fun, you know, Hong Kong midnight movies with like fighting and people on wires, you know, and it's cheap, but you know, it's, you know, a zillion times more entertaining than Last Airbender is, certainly. And the director is Rust.
Ching Su Chung.
Okay, cool.
Which I
had
probably
microwave dinner last night that was about 1,000 times more than okay. Last Airbender.
Yeah, and it, along those lines, I'd also throw out Master of the Flying Guillotine, which is like my favorite kind of go-to, fun, goofy Hong Kong, and it's an older film than Chinese Ghost Story 2, I think. But it stars the one-armed boxer who was in a series of films of his own, and you know, guy with one arm.
The name says it all. Yeah,
pretty much there. But he's, you know, basically it's one of the martial arts tournament movies. So there's kind of there's a storyline that goes around it, but essentially it comes down to this tournament. And the thing about the tournament is that you get to see these people fighting with all of these wildly exaggerated, crazy styles. And if you're a video game fan, you'll recognize the movie as the origin of a couple of Street Fighter characters. Because like Dalsim, the Indian fighter in the Street Fighter series, kind of has his origin in Master of the Flying Guillotine. And there's all these really just kooky fighters. And it has a really bizarre soundtrack that has songs from bands like Kraftwerk, and it's not like the super like We Are the Robots era Kraftwerk. It's very early Kraftwerk when they were more of like kind of this, you know, psych krautrock band, these long winding jams, and so there's these really weird songs that are in the music, and actually one or two of the soundtrack choices in Flying Guillotine was used by Kill Bill or used by Tarantino in a couple of different movies, and Kill Bill, I think in both the Kill Bill films, some of, like a couple of the Master of the Flying Guillotine tracks show up. So it's just a fun, goofy, kind of violent, kind of crazy sort of tournament movie, and I'd rather watch it a dozen times than see the Last Airbender again, cool. ever.
Well, we're at the end, and I would like to thank Cradle of Loafing editor Special Rodell and Debbie Michaud for offering a feminine perspective on the Twilight franchise. And once again, this is Kurt Holman with Cradle of Loafing.
And I'm Matt Goldberg, managing editor of Collider.com. You can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/MattGoldberg, all one word.
And I'm Russ Fisher from SlashFilm.com, and I'm on Twitter at twitter.com/RussFisher, all one word, too.
And thanks for listening all the way through the end.